This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Colin Liddell from the Alternative Right. We're going to be discussing the refugee crisis in Europe. Colin, it's great having you back on.
Yeah, it's nice to be back on.
So you're living in Japan right now?
Yes. Very diverse society, as you may know. They have both men and women and old people and young people here.
You're the most diverse. You're bringing diversity there, I guess.
Yeah, not on purpose, though, you know. But I can't really avoid not bringing diversity. You know, being the sort of wonderfully enriching in person I am.
Is Japan starting to change, or not so much?
I don't think it really is. Occasionally, you'll get some story in the Western media hinting that Japan now realizes the error of its ways and that they will start to become more liberal with their immigration policy, or that, I mean, one big story they had not so long ago, which some people in our particular area might remember, is the Miss Universe Japan who was half black.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, now that got a lot of attention on the internet. But in Japan itself, it got almost no attention, as far as I know. And people I asked about, I asked some people about this, and very few of them had actually heard of it. They didn't know what I was going on about. So Miss Universe Japan doesn't really dominate the media in the way that Miss Universe might do elsewhere. And it's kind of interesting that it's a Donald Trump-owned enterprise as well. So,
that's funny.
Hmm.
So it's an extension of a Western cultural imperialism into Japan.
Yes, but not a very effective one. So yeah, the Japanese people they seem to have little organic inclination to make their society more diverse. The people who are closest to the Japanese are the Koreans and the Chinese. But even there, the Japanese perceive a massive cultural and identitarian gulf, and they would be extremely reluctant to, exacerbate any tensions that would result from that.
Do you talk to people in Japan a lot about these issues, or do you try to keep a low profile?
Well, you know, one reason I stay in Japan is because Japan is one of the few pro-white countries in the world. So if you're white, you tend to be treated reasonably well. Occasionally you encounter sort of petty acts of racism, but nothing that you can't really handle. They are very, very identitarian. They're very, very aware of their Japanese identity. And another important thing I would say is Japan is it's a non-confrontational society. They don't like conflict. You see this in lots of ways. They don't like to argue. They don't like to directly contradict each other. Their legal system reflects this. Even their parliamentary system and the way politicians talk represent this. So they're introducing an ethnic element would chime too well with that non-confrontational culture.
Do you feel a lot more comfortable in Japan than you would in like a multicultural London?
Before I moved to Japan, I was living in multicultural London. And, there's a lot of things I like about London. I was getting a bit fed up with the multiculturalism and having to always be aware of all sorts of things that might offend this group or that group, or looking at people the wrong way, or, you know, just like being on your guard can be misconstrued as offensive to some people. So gradually I just became disillusioned with London, and I could have moved back to my hometown, but there again economic opportunities would have been very, very circumscribed.
Do you plan on staying in Japan for the long run?
No, I always plan on returning to Scotland the next year. I've been planning that for like 10 years now.
What are you most impressed about Japan?
The obvious things are how peaceful and efficient the country is, and they're essentially very tolerant, and that goes into their non-confrontational nature. For example, you could wear very, very outlandish clothes or hairstyles here, and you would not be bothered by other people. So in that sense, you know, that's not maybe to call that tolerance is wrong, because they don't actually tolerate it as such in a positive way, but they have a non-confrontational culture, so they would not get involved in an argument with somebody because of how they dressed.
How does it affect? So let's say a person is being rude. If you're a foreigner and you start acting rude in Japan, mm-hmm. would they confront you about it, or would they just try to ignore you as much as possible?
Oh no, they just probably give you a wide berth. They would think, why should I be the one to get involved with upbraiding the unruly foreigner when it might get me killed or smashed up in some way? So. They would tend to be non-confrontational and just avoid you.
And how does it affect their legal system?
Well, for example, they recently tried to introduce a jury system, and for most of their history, they haven't had a jury system, and they don't have this. In the Western legal system, you have two lawyers, one who prosecutes and one who defends. And Japan doesn't really work in quite the same way. And I think they have three judges, and the judges traditionally put their heads together and look at the evidence and decide whether somebody's innocent or guilty. So of course that sounds a little bit disturbing, because it's a system that could be open to all sorts of abuse. I think partly because of fears over that, they decided to introduce a jury system, but it's far from being a fait accompli. I think it's still in the process of being introduced, and there's lots of reservations about it. So their legal system is in a form of limbo.
And there's is there a culture there of showing. On one hand, they're considered to be xenophobic towards foreigners who want to move there permanently, but to treat the culture is to show hospitality towards a temporary guest.
I wouldn't say. Yeah, I mean, they're very, very identitarian, but that doesn't necessarily equate to xenophobia. Has there a kind of? You see, Japan is essentially a very isolated island culture. So isolated island cultures have a great deal of curiosity and interest in the outside world. You could even equate it with the kind of cargo cult mentality, where they're extremely welcoming to certain aspects of the outside world, but has to being colonized and having mass immigration, there's absolutely no political pool for that.
How has it changed your personal views, or has it just formatted your existing views even further?
Well, it's hard to say, because I think living in Japan, you do become more aware of yourself as a white person. But then that process was already well underway in London. And also, you can the difference is, like, if you become racially aware in London, you tend to become what would be described in a more kind of negative way as racist, i.e. you have negative ideas about the other. Whereas in Japan, when you become more racially aware, your racial awareness is less negative, because you think, you know, the Japanese are different from me. I'm not Japanese and I don't want to be Japanese. But at the same time, I can respect their culture and their civilization. Whereas if that happens in London, you're sort of defining yourself against certain groups, like, for example, black people, Islamic people, and therefore you're kind of almost forced to have a disparaging view of the other.
And also the major groups in London, they're groups that are more likely to get into conflict than people in Japan.
Yeah, so your negative emotions are much more likely to be in play. Whereas in Japan, even though you're very, very racially aware of them as different from you, it's not filtered through negative emotions. It's maybe filtered through, you know, a degree of mutual admiration.
Is there a large Japanese presence in London, or not really?
Oh, there is. There are some Japanese. There are specific areas where you find the Japanese. From what I can remember, there were some Japanese they tended to congregate in areas that had been taken over or which were popular amongst Jews. So, for example, St. John's Wood, you would find some Japanese there. Golders Green, you would find Japanese there. And other parts in Hendon and other parts of North London where you have traditional Jewish neighborhoods, you'd find Japanese there. So I guess they have they like that particular atmosphere. They find that the Jewish neighborhoods are maybe safer and more peaceful, and so they are therefore attracted to those neighborhoods rather than the other neighborhoods which are colonized by the Muslim population or the Afro-Caribbean population.
So we're going to be focusing on is the current refugee crisis in Europe right now.
Yes.
Did you leave England like just before this got started?
Well, do you mean originally or do you mean this summer?
This summer.
Oh yeah, well I went back to the UK this summer, not to England but to Scotland. And yes, this has been cooking up for a long while because you know, even though this took a lot of people by surprise, really this crisis has been going on for years. Really, as first of all, the civil war in Syria is well established, and that's been generating refugees at an enormous rate. And most of them move into Turkey, and then a lot of those have been moving into Greece, and that's been going on for years now. And then added to that, you also have the crisis in Libya, which is, you know, generating a lot of refugees and also allowing through a lot of refugees from other African countries. This latest part of the crisis has been going on for, I think, a couple of weeks or a few weeks now.
So basically what happened is that the refugees, they came in, but they were all concentrated in these countries like Turkey.
Yes.
But the influx into Europe, it all happened all at once. It's in massive numbers. I guess it would be dam breaking.
Yeah, I think what's been going on is a lot of the migrants or welfare shoppers, as I prefer to call them, they've been congregating in Greece. And of course, I think this whole thing is actually intimately connected to the situation in Greece. And, of course, Greece has been going through all sorts of trials and tribulations of its own. And in particular, I think, was it at the beginning of the year, you had the election of a Syriza government. And so you have this very left-wing government, which is completely sympathetic to these economic invaders. And so, but at the same time, Syriza has faced all sorts of economic pressures. And so Greece, whether Greece wants to or not, Greece is going through a process of austerity. And that, of course, means there's less resources available for these migrants. And so scraping by in Greece has become increasingly hard. And so I think the combination of Greek austerity and general left-wing sympathy towards the migrants has allowed them to sort of flow out of Greece and cross the borders, the various borders into Macedonia and then into Serbia and then into Hungary and then onwards to Germany, Austria and the rest of Europe. You see a lot of this is connected to petty local rivalries and dislike of one's neighbours. For example, you know, the Macedonians don't like the Serbs and the Serbs don't like the Hungarians. And so on. And the Greeks don't particularly like the Macedonians, and the Turks definitely don't like the Greeks. And so, I mean, what should be happening?
So is Turkey intentionally encouraged driving these people through?
Well, I would say that the Turks are heavily responsible for this. I mean, they are the source of the migrants. Okay, now the migrants are coming into Syria, and you can call them refugees when they're moving from Syria into Turkey, okay, because they're directly fleeing death and destruction and warfare. So you can say they are technically refugees. Once they get into Turkey, they can live there as refugees. But if they move from Turkey, they are no longer refugees, in my opinion. They're just welfare shoppers. And the
question is Turkey letting them stay there permanently or encouraging them to leave?
Well, Turkey has a very large number of them, and they probably, from their point of view, they probably think, why should we be footing the bill for all this? Why should our society be suffering? So when the migrants express a desire to move on to other countries, the Turkish are quite happy to turn a blind eye, as we say, whereas they shouldn't. I think they have a responsibility to clamp down on these people smugglers who are making a fortune out of ferrying these people across the Greek islands and just dumping them there. Really, what the EU should be doing, they should be imposing economic sanctions on Turkey, and they should be beefing up security there, and they should actually be pushing the boats back into Turkey. And I wouldn't see any problem with that, because it's a different case in Syria, because Syria is a state in an official state of anarchy. So morally, it's harder for the European navies to do that. But in the case of Turkey, Turkey is still technically speaking a peaceful democracy. So to push the boats back into Turkey would be quite legitimate. So I think that's what we should be doing. We should be rounding up any migrants coming into Greece, putting them on boats, and then taking them over to the Turkish coast and kicking them out there.
I've also heard that there's a lot of people who actually are not from Syria. There's people coming as far as from places like Pakistan, and they're actually getting like fake Syrian passports.
Oh yeah, you don't even need a passport. You just have to show up and say, look, I've lost my passport, I'm Syrian. Therefore, can I claim my prize of unlimited welfare?
And then there's also the way from sub-Saharan Africa, which is totally different than the Syrian situation.
Oh yeah, even some of them are claiming to be Syrian. Yeah, so the whole world wants to move to Europe. Yeah, I guess we should be flattered at some level, But, I think a better solution would be if we went back to these countries and colonized them, because obviously they seem to have a real taste for European government.
So I was reading this, that none of the Gulf states agreed to accept any of the migrants, but Saudi Arabia says that they won't take in any refugees,
mm-hmm.
but that they're willing to build 200 mosques for every 100 refugee who arrives in Germany. This is Saudi Arabia.
Yes, they really, really detest these Syrian migrants, but at the same time they want them to retain their Islamic identity. So that's very touching of the Saudis. How kind and generous. So yeah, just the fact that just those kinds of facts should make any sane person deeply, deeply cynical about the whole thing. And that does look like the Saudis see this, whether other people do or not. It definitely indicates that the Saudis see this as an invading army that will enable them to exert more influence in those countries.
Well, Saudi Arabia created a lot of the problem with the rebels, so I'm sure a lot of Syrians despise Saudi Arabia, but it's sort of a way for them to make them, to brainwash them into the Saudi brand of like Wahhabism. Syria has actually traditionally been one of the more moderate Muslim countries.
Yeah. The whole Middle East is a massive mess, but there is a kind of proxy war going on between the West and Russia, and in that proxy war, the Saudis are our proxies, and Iran is the proxy of Russia, and then they have their proxies as well, which is Bashar al-Assad, and the Saudis are not happy with that. Now, the other problem is if you start to follow the ethnic map of the region and start to give these different national, religious, and tribal groups their own states or statelets, this has all sorts of repercussions. One of the other things about Syria is about 9% of the population are Kurdish, And right now, the Kurds control most of the ethnic Kurdish territory. And so to create a Kurdish state in Syria or Iraq, because also in the case of Iraq, the Kurds could control their own ethnic area now as well, even though the fiction of a united Iraq is still maintained. But once you start to create Kurdish states, then that causes severe problems for a country like Turkey, which is also a very artificial country in many respects. And so that would destabilize Turkey. There's talk now that Turkey is starting to slide towards a state of semi-civil war.
Are most of the refugees coming in from Syria, are most of them Sunni Muslims? Are a significant number Christian?
Well, most of them would be Sunni Muslims simply because they're the majority. But I'd say also a lot of them are Christians. I'd even say some of them are probably Alawites, because the Alawite population, they have their own problem with the government, because the government is relying very, very heavily on them for support, which means that very, very large numbers of young Alawite men have been drafted into the Syrian army and have died. And so they have been like bleeding young men at a very high rate. And a lot of the tribal leaders amongst the Alawites are now complaining about that. And so I would suggest that, those tensions suggest that probably a lot of Alawites have had enough of the situation as well.
You commented on the situation with Yazidis. You posted this picture of the slave market where there's you have a picture of an ISIS member with his hand around a small blonde girl.
Yeah, that's a very well-known picture. It's apparently a picture of a forced wedding between a girl who's probably about 6 or 7, or it's hard to say, and a fully grown member of ISIS. And while she seems to be crying at her own wedding, he's smirking. And this is a typical picture which is used to demonize ISIS. And, I've got nothing against ISIS being demonized, but I'd rather we didn't do that too much, because the agenda behind that is, we have to go and do something about it. And my personal view is that unless we have a real plan to deal with the Middle East, we shouldn't be wasting Western money and Western lives to enact it, because what would happen? We just go in there, have another pointless war, lose trillions of dollars more, and thousands of more Western lives, and then we just end up leaving, and then the situation would revert back to ISIS Mark II or something. So I'm just not in favor of those pointless interventions.
Oh, the subcaption of that point said, the subcaption says, those who should be refugees can't. Yes. Are you saying that they're blocking Yazidis?
Well, I'm saying that the real people that need to be considered refugees, people who are, you know, in real danger, the weak, the feeble, the sick, the old, children, those are very, very underrepresented amongst the groups that are pouring into Europe. So those people who are pouring across the various European borders are, by no stretch, are they refugees. Young men can be refugees, but even then it looks a bit bad. I mean, you know, why are they running away? They should be standing and fighting for their women and children. The fact that they're all young men migrating in large groups to Europe implies that they actually abandoned their old mothers and their children and their wives and, just up sticks and went to Europe because of their greed for the good life.
And that would cause a lot of instability, importing large numbers of young men who are not bringing women with them.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of them would be unemployed. It's going to create a lot of problems.
It's a very interesting situation. Like in Europe, we already have enough Muslims, as most people already know. There are more than enough Muslims to create more than enough problems for our societies. And, in the case of the UK, there's the famous, infamous Rotherham case where this is just one town and it's just one of many where over a period of 16 years, 1400 underage English girls were groomed, raped, and drugged up, and whatever, you know what I mean? So now, because of cases like Rotherham, and because of the toxicity of those kinds of cases, because those kinds of cases tend to, if they subsist, they tend to stimulate a nationalist response. And for the British ruling class, a healthy nationalist response is considered toxic. Now, those kinds of situations are not tenable in modern Britain. So the British establishment is forced to clamp down on this kind of rape culture of Pakistani gangs and Muslim gangs. Now, I tend to think that could actually have repercussions, because if you clamp down on Muslim rape gangs, then you have that might express itself in more Muslims becoming even more radicalized and turn into other forms of one of the problems that you have with this mass immigration is you have these Muslims coming into Europe, and once they're in Europe, they are at the bottom of the pile socially. They are the underclass, and because they're the underclass, they feel a strong sense of inferiority. Now, how do they cope with this psychological state of inferiority? Now, one way they do that is through putting one over the host population. Now, I would say that one of the things fueling this Pakistani rape culture is this feeling of Pakistani inferiority. Now, if they are not allowed to rape, then how else do they overcome this state of inferiority? That another way that Muslims in Europe deal with this psychological problem is by becoming radicalized as Muslims and by looking down on decadent Western society. So clamping down on the rape culture might actually boost this radical Islamic culture. Now, you're going to have another massive influx of Middle Eastern young men, and of course, you know, again, you're going to have this problem of them being at the bottom of the pile. Most of them, some of them will be fine, obviously. They'll be handsome, intelligent, well-spoken ones who should be able to find a white girlfriend. But most of them will be, unable to communicate properly. They'll look, they'll be economically disadvantaged, etc. And they'll look dirty and sinister to most attractive women. And so they will be excluded in that way. And that will lead to either more rape or more Islamic radicalization or both.
And that's always, I was reading somewhere, even when England took in refugees from Germany after World War II, in small numbers, they only took in families. They actually forbid young single men from coming in.
Yeah, it's a very sensible rule. Young men should not be considered as refugees. And if they want to be considered as refugees, they should be put in some kind of camp until the situation in their home country stabilizes to the point where they can be sent back.
I know the country of Slovakia said they only want to take in Christians.
Yeah, that's. I think it was the Czechs said that. Probably the Slovakians, I should imagine they would say something similar. The Poles are very much the same way. So there is a real divide between ex-members of the Soviet bloc and the Nordic countries, including Germany. The French and the Italians are also less accommodating. Britain is an interesting case. David Cameron, he's been doing what he can to resist this influx.
That's interesting, because I was under the impression that David Cameron was fairly pro-immigration.
I would say that in general he probably is, and Britain's immigration statistics are shameful at the moment. But he's more in favour of people coming into work people from Eastern Europe, qualified people to work for various companies in the tech sector or the financial sector, things like that. He's much less in favor of unskilled traumatized refugees. Now, one reason for that is because even though the British nationalist right has been pushed down, and you know, with the collapse of the British National Party, it's been in the doldrums. There's still a very, very strong nationalistic streak in Britain, and a lot of that has gone into UKIP. I mean, I wouldn't describe UKIP as a nationalist party by any stretch, but they are an anti-immigration party, and they do channel this this sort of unease about mass immigration.
Well, they've been described as civic nationalists.
Yeah, they their whole thing is they're against Europe, and they don't want people coming in from Europe, but they tend to be more accommodating to members of the Commonwealth countries, which is not really...
I think Nigel Farage actually said he would rather have people from the Commonwealth than from Poland.
Yes, and I'd much rather have people from Poland than from the Commonwealth, because the Commonwealth is mainly black and Asian. And we do have white people in the Commonwealth, but most of them are quite happy where they are. So, Nigel Farage, Nigel Farage has to take that kind of position, because you know, his problem is he is a soft nationalist, but he, you know, with any kind of nationalist politician in Britain, you are in immense danger of being demonized and you know, cast as some kind of monster by the media. So what you should do then, you should be if you have one policy which is anti-immigration, which can be construed as racist, you have to have another policy which can offset that. And to a certain extent, you see that with Trump. I mean, I think Trump, you know, Trump's whole appeal is his racism. That's the reason why American people are flocking to him, because he's out there, he's saying, build a wall, send them back. You know, very, very racist by, you know, the standards of the contemporary culture. And people love it. But, you know, the problem with that is if he just...
What do people in Japan think about Donald Trump, or they're not talking about that?
Oh, no, he's not well known. Just very intelligent people who know about politics and economics would have heard of him. He hasn't really registered yet, but Trump is offsetting. You know, he has an image that is in danger of becoming too stereotypically racist, and so he has to actually make positive noises on the other side. So he's talked about his great big fat door for illegal immigration, and he's actually said, you know, we should be helping the Syrians, but we can't, you know. So he's you know, he's sort of playing both sides of the field there, and he has to do that. And Nigel Farage, in a sense, has to do that. But how sincere are these people? You know what I mean? Because I think Nigel Farage and the UKIP's appeal is to British people, the appeal is because of its racism. But at the same time, you can't just bang on about that one thing. You've got, otherwise you end up looking like this kind of Hitlerian caricature that the media love to impose on you. And this is exactly what happened to the BNP. The BNP was in many ways, a perfectly respectable party that was against this sort of process of white genocide. And, you know, but, and that they also tried to offset. I mean, they were very friendly to members of the Sikh community, for example, and they made positive noises about the Gurkhas and so on. But, you know, so you can never put all your cards out there all at once. You have to play a political game. And in the case of David Cameron, he is, I don't think he's, I mean, it's hard to say what these people really think deep down in their heart. Do they even think about, you know, am I British and should I keep Britain British, and should I worry about the country for my children and my children's children? You can never be sure what they're really thinking. But from the various positions that Cameron's taken up, I'd say he's mainly a soulless pragmatist, and he tends to go along with mass immigration because it fits the interests of the global economic system. But at the same time, he has to be very, very politically aware of his situation. His situation is if masses of Muslim migrants are pouring into Britain, it's going to stoke up nationalist feeling, which is going...
It already has. I know the recent polls show Marine Le Pen is the front runner in France for the election.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been developing for a very long time. But in the case of Cameron, you know, he has to worry a great deal about his right flank, because if the situation in Britain it became like Germany, UKIP would be like trouncing the Conservative Party, and so he's very, very worried about keeping UKIP in check. So that's why he's made some kind of effort to keep this influx in under some kind of control. I mean, until recently, he was saying we're only going to have a few Syrian refugees from the refugee camps bordering Syria. But he's come under a lot of pressure from the Germans, because the Germans have this massive influx of Syrians and pseudo-Syrians and people who travelled along the same road with the Syrians. And they are finding it very hard to deal with them all by themselves. And they're saying, this isn't fair, guys. You've got to share the load here. And, the Germans have said they expect to have about 800,000 to a million migrants this year alone. And a great part of that is the recent influx of refugees or pseudo-refugees. And I think Cameron has now agreed to take 20,000 over 5 years. So you can see there he's still kind of dragging his heels. He's trying to say something that sounds good to the emotionally driven narrative of the present moment. Because right now, you know, the media is doing its usual atrocious job of making everybody feel guilty and sorry for these poor helpless people. And of course, right now that's the way the wind's blowing. So he's got to sort of go along with that to a certain extent and come over as a nice guy. But at the same time, he has to be a pragmatic, steely pragmatist. And so he's still dragging his heels there.
I think also the thing is, it's sort of like the frog in the blowing pan theory, is if these changes happen gradually, then they'll become more like permanent change. But when something happens so fast in such a short period of time, that can create a massive backlash.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the one good thing about this crisis, because, you know, like I said, this has been going on for years. We've had years and years of boatloads of so-called migrants coming over and, gradually spreading through Europe, and it's all been under the radar. I mean, it's been a very, very kind of newsworthy story, but the media has not really been focusing on it. And it's almost like you need things to go wrong before people realize they're wrong. And so you do actually need chaos. You need acts of terrorism. You need, shocking and tragic events. And, this recent influx is liable to generate them. And so it's sort of bringing a lot of the problems that have been there for a long while to the surface. And one of the main problems is our, our basic attitude, basic Western attitudes are completely self-destructive. We have this kind of liberal leftist outlook that all people are the same and give everybody a chance and treat people as individuals. And, it sounds all very nice to a certain type of person, but... it doesn't really make for successful states. And so we do need to recover that sense of ourself as a people and as a culture and as a people and a culture worth defending. And that involves being a little bit racist. And we do need to get back to being a little bit racist. And, maybe that might be the beneficial side of this crisis. It might make it easier for people to wake up and to confront some of the unpleasant facts that having a kind of wishy-washy left-wing humanitarian outlook involves.
Can you go into some more detail about the situation in Germany and what Angela Merkel is doing. She's granting asylum to as many as 800,000. So Germany is taking in by far the largest number.
Yeah, I think the Germans really got caught on the back foot by this. And you know what happened was you had this massive influx coming out of Greece, and then once it got to Serbia, the Serbians were just like fast forwarding them to Hungary, and the Hungarians were sort of caught left footed as well, and they tried to put up some sort of border defense, but then you saw these scenes of the migrants just running around the police. And running around the camera crew, because it was a famous case where this Hungarian camera woman was sticking her foot out to trip up these migrants. So at least she was trying to do her part. But you know, once you had this sudden insurge of migrants, now the Germans could have acted with efficiency, and we all know the Germans can be very, very efficient when they want to be, and they could have cracked down, but. Morally and emotionally, the Germans find that kind of behavior very hard to do. Just this year, the Germans were being blamed for being too strict and severe on the Greeks. A few months ago, you had the negotiations between Tsipras and the Troika, and which is essentially the German-dominated EU, and there, at that point, the Germans were being called Nazis because they were trying to emphasize that the Greeks should pay their debts. And, you know, the Germans can only handle so much bad publicity that compares them to Hitler. And so when this problem flared up, instead of taking the firm Teutonic response, they swung the other way. They went the opposite way. And they became over-accommodating. And so they've kind of got themselves into a bit of a pickle, and they really expect the rest of Europe to help them out here. And so it's almost like a laughable situation.
And it's also important to point out that the U.S. foreign policy played a major role in creating this mess. The Iraq war, the arming of the rebels, and removing Gaddafi.
Yeah, I think the Middle East has always been a mess, and you know, I think people should just like leave it alone as much as possible and let it evolve its own organic power structures, no matter how gruesome and vile they may appear to us. Because if we don't do that, the same organic forces that will generate those loathsome political structures will actually start generating them in Europe. And that's what's going to happen because of what's happening in the Middle East. We're going to actually have the Middle East in Europe.
Do you think at some point there could be like a civil war similar to what happened in Yugoslavia?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, it would be really nice if we could, everybody could wake up and be sensible about this and, you know, like repatriate all these, you know, cultural and racial invaders. But we both know that's not going to happen. We both know that things are going to go down the path of least resistance, and probably at some stage, there will either be a gradual boiling of the frog, or else the frog will wake up and there will be a civil war. And if there is a civil war, it's pretty obvious who will win it. I mean, you know, it's not going to be the Arabs.
Well, didn't the United States get involved in the civil war in Yugoslavia? The United States got involved to protect the Muslims and to create Kosovo.
Let's see. Now, the civil war in Yugoslavia, that was a bit of a mess as well, yeah. I think at that point, yeah, now, in those years, America, America has always, well, let's see, America has been cucking for Israel for some time now, and there is a cost to cucking for Israel. The main cost for cucking for Israel is that it completely alienates the Arab world. And the Arab world, you don't want to alienate the Arab world too much, because if you do that, then that causes all sorts of structural geopolitical problems. America has to maintain the dollar through the petrodollar arrangement. That means they have to maintain the situation in countries like the Gulf states. Now, if the Arab street becomes too alienated, then it becomes harder and harder for America and the arrangements in the Gulf states. So I think the American intervention in Yugoslavia was a way of offsetting their negative image in the Muslim world. It was a way to show the Muslim world, look, okay, we cop for the Jews, but look at us here. We're helping you guys, so we're not all bad.
If nationalists were to come to power in a European nation, what would their foreign policy be and relations be with Middle Eastern countries?
Well, I think Europe has legitimate interests in the Middle East. And I think if we had a healthy nationalist Europe that wasn't fighting with itself, which is, you know, always the big danger when Europe becomes nationalist, we might have competing nationalisms like we've had in the past. And that's the main problem for nationalism in Europe, is we have to avoid repeating the pointless wars of the past when whites fought against whites, Europeans killed Europeans. If we could create a healthy nationalist Europe of various European states, we would have collective interests in the Middle East, and so we would want to have a foreign policy that gave us some kind of hegemony over a relatively stable Middle East. So I would I guess we'd want the Middle East to be a collection of small ethno-states that were tied to the European Confederation in some way. Whether other major powers would allow that to happen, of course, is a very, very major question.
Would it have a significant impact on the geopolitical power balance in the Middle East if Europe became more nationalistic?
Well, you see, the process of becoming nationalist would be very traumatic for Europe, and there would be a period probably of reduced global influence. And so, you know, we'd have to we'd be dealing with a lot of problems. By transitioning to nationalism, we would there'd be all sorts of repercussions economically and so on. But I think in the long run, it would greatly strengthen Europe, and then we'd have to project some of our power. And, you know, we'd have to look to the Middle East, because the Middle East is very close to Europe. It's also strategically very important. It's where our oil would come from, mainly. And also, you know, we do have vested interests in Africa. So, you know, I think a nationalist Europe would actually have to be a semi-colonial Europe. We couldn't just allow areas like Africa and the Middle East to be run by America and China. We'd have to contest that at some level.
How much influence does the Gulf states have over Europe and England in particular?
The Gulf states, well, the Arabs have a lot of money, which they pump into various mosques and madrasas. They also... the city of London, as you know, is this very important financial capital. And the Arabs have a lot of spare change. And so a lot of that money finds its way to London one way or the other. And so that constrains the degree to which we can respond with full honesty to Middle Eastern situations.
So, before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to add about the situation that I didn't get to touch upon?
I'm done here. I think I've said enough.
Okay, so, Colin Liddell, thanks for being on.
It's been a pleasure.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care and we'll be back with you next time.